Hey there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. And now, we hope you enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and on this episode of Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about trading magic items in your D&D games. Can you buy them? Can you sell them? Can you start up a hedge fund? All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Dan, how did this topic come up? What inspired this?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you asked that because we had an earlier episode on trading and mercantilism in D&D games. And Paul and I did that episode. And we were like, this is the kind of thing that we are interested in. Probably nobody else is really going to care about it. And it's one of our most popular episodes. And so we were thinking about, like, you know, that does actually, you know, isn't a topic that interests us. And so a couple weeks back, we were looking for things to talk about. And I asked Paul, do you should we talk about trading magic items? And Paul's response was, never. No way. Don't allow it. It doesn't happen in my games. Nothing to talk about. The end. I'm like, okay, that's unusually robust thesis. And then a couple weeks later, I'm like, wait a minute. I've been in Paul's games and I have totally purchased potions and scrolls. So what's up with that? There is something we need to investigate. And that's where this show came from.
Excellent. Yeah. It's funny. I remember having that conversation because I was like, I was a little worried that I just wasn't going to have that much to say. Cause I'm like, I just don't allow it. I just don't do it. But I realized I kind of have drawn a line between consumables, like you said, potions and scrolls and everything else. And when you get into scrolls in particular, that gets into a much thornier conversation about, like, how do you roll out spells to your wizards in the game, right? Yeah. How do wizards learn new spells? I know newer editions, like, it's just rolled into leveling. You know, characters just immediately get access to new spells every level. That's not what I'm used to in old school gaming. I'm used to, like, good luck, go find some spells. So, I don't know. That aside, I think we're going to try and I'm going to try and sidestep that topic because that's probably a whole other conversation.
It might be tied into it. I feel like that's important. And like Paul just said, in my last game, I totally had wizard characters who leveled up and there were no spells available for their highest spell level. I'm like, what are you going to do about that now? But, you know, it's an interesting topic because it's one of these, you know, the magic shop issue is one of these things that have really ping-ponged around in different editions of D&D. They've gone yes, they've gone no, they've gone maybe, they've gone we recommend it, we don't recommend it. And it tends to be very lightly touched upon sometimes about whether that's the intention for core D&D or not. And different editors have flip-flopped back and forth about it. So it's an interesting, I guess, proud nail or point of pain in the game about whether that should be allowed or not.
It's fascinating. There was the thing I remember most strongly of it, the historical moment that I think really cemented in my mind that I don't like it. It's early 90s. I'm playing second edition AD&D a lot, and I had gone to like my first couple of Gen Cons ever and gotten involved in playing some of the organized play at the time, which I think they called Living City. I want to say they called it Living City or Living Greyhawk or some Living something.
Yeah, Living anyway. Greyhawk started 2000. I think Living City was earlier.
Yeah, I think it was Living City. And So the thing is that they had kind of formalized the value of magic items for the purposes of that system. Yep. They had formalized the value of magic items so that they could be more easily traded. And there was an issue of Polyhedron magazine that came out that I was receiving at the time. I had a subscription to Polyhedron as a valid RPGA member, had the pin, all that. And I remember an article coming out about, like, you know, so-and-so's magic shop. I can't remember what it was, but it was just sort of like your typical thing you see in Dragon Magazine or whatever. That's like just describing a little background of here's, you know, this character, he's got a magic shop in the living city, blah, blah, blah. And then it went heavy into like, here's the price of all the magic items.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then just, I remember that article coming out and digging through that and then being excited to include that in my games and then like, you know, adding actual magic shops. And I did not like the impact that had on my games at the time. I'll put it that way.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I didn't, it really felt like it robbed the mystery of magic items. Like they just became a commodity. And
yep.
And it was, I didn't like it. Didn't like it at all.
And likewise, I think in that same vein, in short, that was not, you know, buying and selling magic items was not built in to the zero edition rules. Mm-hmm. And then they had big, long, comprehensive tables in the first edition AD&D rules. Every single magic item had a sale price attached. And then that was taken out in second edition. So Dave Cook came through in second edition, and it, to a large part, that's pretty much a copy paste of the rules from first edition, but he very carefully sliced out all the sale values in second edition, and then it came back in third. And then in third, every single item in the game has a specific sale price, and it specifically says in the book. And so what I remember is that if you make a character in third edition, just exactly like Paul just said, you are allowed to pick any magic item for a particular price point at that level. And I had a roommate at the time that I introduced to D&D at a slightly higher level, and he spent a whole week optimizing the initial magic item purchases for his character. And I felt so bad. I felt so bad. And he was sitting there with a spreadsheet that somebody else had developed, pinging that I could buy this, but I could buy that. I could get a better armor. I could get a better weapon. He spent a whole week optimizing, and I felt so bad about that. And that's what made me not want that kind of open access in my game either.
Yeah, yeah. Here's a couple of interesting comments going through on the chat right now. So I'm just going to share a couple of things.
Please.
That's interesting. Okay. Julian directed right at me, Paul, would you still feel that way if the shop had only scrolls and potions? And I just want to relatedly add in William's comment, who said, well, any old alchemist can make a potion, but you need wizards and dragon's blood and a full moon to make fancy stuff. So here's my thought. I feel like what bothers me is when it becomes just that sort of commodity, right? When it becomes like going to the grocery store or the drugstore or whatever, then it's boring.
If
the shop has lots of character and there are lots of like arcane ritual and rules around it, like I start to feel better about it. And I'll tell you specifically how potions and scrolls made it back into my campaign. In my campaign that I started around 2010, I started with L1, The Secret of Bone Hill. And so I have the town of Restonford, and basically I have the whole town detailed. That was my starting point. That was my base camp for my players. And if you've read L1, you notice that there's a major wizard in there, Peltar the Sorcerer. And he has three apprentices who are also detailed, who are somewhere. And there's even an inn that points out that like this is where they like to hang out. And my players were looking for, especially my wizard players, my magic users, were trying to find ways to add more spells to their spell book. And so they talked to Peltar and they asked, like, do you have any magic scrolls that we can use to scribe scrolls to our spell book? And I thought about it and I kind of thought, you know what, it would make sense if Peltar's apprentices occasionally scribe scrolls as just part of their apprenticeship. Like that's how they train maybe to become wizards. So I said, okay, I'll sell scrolls, but I'm going to limit it in these ways. I'm going to say, one, no higher spell level than third level, because that's about like once you get to Fireball territory, it feels like this magic should be much more rare to me. And so I'm like, maybe if you're very, very lucky, they might have a Fireball, probably not. And I ramped the price that way too. Like the first level spells, pretty trivial, not too expensive. Second level spells, more than double that. And the third level spell is like crazy expensive. Okay. And then I also randomized stock. So anytime they came and talked to him, I was like, well, let's see what they made over the past month. And I would roll dice for it. And I would just use, I would actually use Dan's Book of Spells, which conveniently in the table of contents, there are numbers next to all the spells. So they can be rolled upon with dice. And so I can't remember. I think it was, I would roll like a D6 for the number of first level spells that they had. And like a D3 for the number of second level spells, and maybe something like a, you know, a D0 to 1 for what third level spells they had. And,
I like it.
And then I would randomize which spells they actually were. So
I like it.
Yeah, that's what I did.
It worked well at being on the player side of that, and I definitely like, you know, not having full access to the whole list, right? Yeah. So if you had the entire list in the book, be like, you can just pick anything off this like it's a menu. I liked having limited access and having it be randomized from week to week what was available. Then it felt special, and it felt like you're going through a record store and you're finding a little treasure there. And for me, I again, really liked having this limited access that you had to hunt for over time.
Yeah. No, I did have, through play in that same campaign, I had players come at me with, I specifically want this specific magic item. I had a player who was playing a halfling thief who was angry at the fact that he didn't have dark vision or infravision or whatever, you know, low light vision that the elves and dwarves had. He's like, I'm a thief. I should be able to move around in the dark. I really want a magic item that will let me see in the dark. And so he just started talking to NPCs about it. He would ask Paltar or ask other, you know, random NPCs, right, have you ever heard of a magic item that lets you see in the dark? And one, I'm like, that doesn't sound like a very powerful magic item, so I don't feel too bad about introducing that to the game. And two, I like that he was interacting with the world and talking to the NPCs. So I started looking through the adventures I had, and I was like, let me find a random, okay, here's a dungeon that they haven't visited yet. I'm going to chuck a magic item in there that is a hat that grants you infravision, and then I'm going to make up a legend about it. Yep. Oh, yes, I heard that the ancient Amorians did make such a device. And possibly if you visit the ruins, an ancient Amorian ruin, maybe you would find one. Yeah.
I mean, that's the way that my heart goes, is like, here's an opportunity for an adventure.
Right.
Someone wants something in the game. Well, then that want is your perfect hook into actual adventuring. So my attitude has also generally been like, the price, there's a price, and the price is you got to go on an adventure. And it's funny because not everybody feels the same way, right? I've had some players like groan at that, like, oh, why do I have to go adventuring? Right. Well, yeah. Right. I mean, you know, maybe I was doing a bad job of presenting it or something like that. But that's what it seemed to come off as. Or maybe they were play acting, and it didn't get through my OCD. I don't know. But you know, some people do. Their instinct is that there should be magic shops or auction houses, and so, you know, the magic shop is a sufficiently well known trope in D&D type fantasy at this point that it's all over the place. I just happened to go to my weekly Sunday Ogliff cartoon this morning, and it happened to occur in a magic shop, as a matter of fact, that was selling potions. And we can't put the comic up on screen in our episode, but you can go find the Glamour Aid. I love Ogliff myself. It's the Glamour Aid episode. And things don't turn out as well as you'd think to begin with. I'll just say that.
Yeah.
But there is a potion shop, and that's, you know, part of a lot of people's expectations for a fantasy world. You might want. I'm interested in. I mean, again, a couple of great comments there. I'm interested in William's second to last comment, where he figures there must be a market for magic items.
Go ahead, just read it out to us, Dan.
So William says, I figure there must be a market for magic items, but it is more like rare art and the collectibles world. They go for sale at auctions, probably secret auctions that you never heard of and need an invite. And it's interesting that William says that, because that's pretty much exactly what is suggested currently in the 5th edition D&D DM's guide. And in fact, let me just look here. So I'm looking at that section under the possibility of buying and selling. And on the one hand, the 5th edition rules nowadays, they suggest their first, their initial suggestion is, unless you decide your campaign works otherwise, most magic items are so rare they aren't available for purchase. And the next paragraph says, in a large city with an academy of magic, this might be an option. And it says, if your world includes a large number of adventurers engaged in retrieving ancient magic items, trade in those items might be more common. Even so, it's likely to remain similar to the market for fine art in the real world, with invitation-only auctions and a tendency to attract thieves. How do you feel about that, Paul? How do you feel about this? Yeah, right.
I mean, it sounds like you're slowly stepping towards and leaning into the like, and now this is an adventure, and now this is a whole session where we role play stuff out,
okay,
and yep, something right, goes awry, okay. Right? You bid on yep. a thing, you go and you pay for it, and then when you go to pick it up, right. It gets stolen. Like that sounds great to me. Like, yeah, let's. You know, okay. I think that's it. Liz, the way I want my players to pay for magic items is through play, right? Not through just yeah. deduct coins off their character sheet. I want them to have to work for it and like go through an adventure and establish and make the world richer as a result.
That's what legit. I want. But what about, a little while back, Joshua reminded us about Dave Hargrave's Arduin Grimoire, where there is a multiversal trading company outpost down the dungeon. So if you find the right place in your mega dungeon, there is a general buying and selling and trading in the dungeon itself. And of course, that also harkens back to my understanding of Gygax's Castle Greyhawk is that there was a post of guardian elves right outside the entrance to the dungeons. And I believe to get out, you had to pay a toll of a magic item every time you came out, I believe. Jeez. Which is kind of interesting because on the one hand, some people say that, you know, early games were really super stingy. But on the other hand, there must have been enough magic floating around that the party could dependably get one or more yeah. items per yeah. session.
Yeah. So here's, I mean, an interesting thing that we're bordering into here is one of the cases more recently where this came up for me is in playing a fifth edition campaign. Now, interesting points about this campaign is it was long running with a group of many GMs. So we were, in fact, taking it in turns to who was the GM, right? And I had recently gone on a tirade about the fifth edition rule for attunement. I specifically don't
yes,
like the attuning
right,
rule.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. And so I was like, let's get rid of it. Let's get rid of attunement. I hate it. It's dumb. But the thing is, it is attempting, though I think poorly, to solve a problem, which is players carrying on way too many magic items mm-hmm. and just being able to have and be able to trade them across with each other willy-nilly. And just, again, it kind of gets down to like treating them like a commodity rather than, you know, amazing artifacts that they're meant to be. So I was like, let's get rid of attunement. And that's fine if you have exactly one GM with their hand firmly on the throttle of how frequently and how much and what kinds of magic items are being handed out. And it turns out, if you just get rid of that rule and you're in a rotating GM game, and different GMs will have different opinions on how many magic items should be in the game, and suddenly our game was flooded with them, and players had way too many, and they were able to just use them and trade them amongst each other, and magic items became boring.
Fascinating. Oh, I hadn't known how that came out, Paul. I'm so glad you told me that.
Yeah. So I'm kind of on the fence about attunement these days, where I'm like, I still don't like it as a rule. I still don't think it's very good. It's inelegant, but it is solving a problem.
Right.
And I don't have a better solution for that problem other than just, you know, be a hard ass. Which is fine.
It's funny because that's a fifth edition innovation.
Attunement.
Attunement was not a thing that was in any edition 0, 1, 2, 3, 4 basic BX anything. And I'm like, I'm surprised that like, why did I not see this as a problem before? Like why I never felt like I was lacking a rule for that in prior editions. And I'm surprised, like, why didn't this feel like a necessary thing to clamp down on players sharing magic items before? I'm kind of at a loss. Did I just not have enough items in my game that was an issue or something like that?
I don't know. Certainly, you know, fifth edition ramps up. I don't know. was going to say 5th edition ramps up the variety of magic items, but I'm not sure that's actually true. But 5th edition certainly has more character abilities, right? You have a lot more different classes with a lot of different more abilities coming to them. And I think 5th edition wants to focus on those more and kind of step away from the magic items. Whereas I do feel like in old school D&D, especially at high level, I think your character does start to get defined by what magic items they own.
True. Undeniable. I think, original D&D fighters had no abilities except hitting a bunch of times if against one hit die opponents. And in fact, the original D&D block for fighters is exactly one paragraph, and it says their primary ability is to use any kind of weapon-based magic item. And a lot of people would argue that specifically keys into the intelligent special ability swords rules that Dave Arneson wrote, because fighters are the only type that can use those swords. And so in most of our classic games, your characters were largely identified by what kind of magic items they had later on. Totally true. I'll say this. Okay, I saw an interesting little side tangent here. I saw an interesting anecdote on D&D Twitter the other day about a DM who was making custom magic items, was a little bit worried about this issue about freely sharing them. So they made one magic item that just totally absorbed all damaging spells. So targeted spells, area spells, no problem. The person wearing it, totally immune, no rolls whatsoever. Now, what he didn't tell the players is that he was tracking how many points it had absorbed over time. Okay. And at some later date, when they were in the city, another character said, "Well, I'm going to go do something risky. Can you hand me that item that just absorbs all the magic?" And what the DM had never, what they never found out, and I guess if they'd scanned it for a curse, they would have gotten clues, but they never found out that when you take it off, all the damage comes back right then.
That's brilliant.
And the city got nuked.
Oh, jeez.
And the whole city just went up in a mushroom cloud.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
Now, what are the chances that that's going to show up in a 5th edition core book? None. Right. That is not something that they're going to want to have. That's completely off the rails and is really, really has to be like a custom unique thing that your campaign is okay with. that's one thing that used to happen actually is the very first supplement to original D&D, the Greyhawk, is most of the magic items are actually cursed versions of the original magic items in the little brown book. All the items in Greyhawk are actually just cursed, twisted versions of the things that you wanted. So that once upon a time, that used to be the response, is if things got out of hand, then you start handing out curses and destructive stuff. Again, that's not something that you, maybe like in a tournament situation, you can't depend on.
I mean, so here's, let me just read from you from the 5th edition DMG. Here's a little blurb they say about attunement when they're talking about specifically about inventing your own magic items and whether or not they should require attunement. The advice is decide whether an item requires a character to be attuned to it to use its properties. Use these rules of thumb to help you decide. If having all the characters in a party pass an item around to gain its lasting benefit would be disruptive, the item should require attunement. If the item grants a bonus that other items also grant, it's a good idea to require attunement so the characters don't try to collect too many of those items. So they're trying to solve stacking, and they're trying to solve pass around.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Now, personally, one of my biggest gripes about attunement is that it is a backdoor to identification. So just by attuning, I now know all the properties of the magic item. And I don't like that. I like the moment in old school games, especially with players who are more used to newer stuff, where they say, "Oh, here's this ring. I've detected magic on these boots. How do I find out what they do?" And the answer is, put them on. They're never comfortable with that. They're always like, "Wait, really? Right. Yeah, like, yeah, okay, put them on. All right, nothing happens. I jump up and down." Yes. Right? Now we're playing D&D.
They should be uncomfortable. Yes. See, I'm from discomfort in my D&D. That's what I'm used to. That's how I came into D&D. That's how I'm going out. Highly uncomfortable. But, you know, it's interesting with the attunement because a couple comments back there, William's first thought was, he said, I feel like they took attunement from the Ring of Regeneration or something in prior editions. There was a rule you had to wear it for a day to keep people from trading it around to heal up. And as soon as Paul says attunement, Ring of Regeneration is also the first thing that pops into my head. What edition did that special rule come in with? Because that is not in original or first edition. So now I'm wondering what edition, which rule? The Regeneration Ring.
That's interesting. Yeah, I don't know.
At some point, they attached it just for that.
I did have a Ring of Regeneration in my campaign, and it's funny because I also worried about how it was going to be used. And I personally enjoyed I wanted the players to share it around. I made it you can absolutely share it around, no problems. I just changed this form factor from a ring to a very flimsy crown made out of twigs and branches and shit. So it was like very delicate. And I was like, you know, fireball, definitely going to destroy this. You know, wear it on your head while in combat, probably going to get destroyed. Right. And they were super paranoid about it. It was great. They built custom boxes to carry it around in. And it was wonderful. It was wonderful. I really enjoyed all the ridiculous play that it got. So yeah, that's another piece of advice, I guess, of like play with the form factor of your magic items.
And then, you know, and then that comes into like, should they be more destructible, frankly? But we'll leave that for another discussion in general. But those are things that, those are things that work great in a campaign. And then again, depending on how important the convention tournament system seems in the particular era, right? Things get twisted around in order to support people coming to the table with a higher level character with a specific number of magic items. And then I would say probably third edition is where they went the most overboard in that late 90s, early 2000s era. So let me put you on the spot, Paul. And I feel like, so obviously there's a difference between buying and selling. And it's a little bit hazy, but at least if you look at first edition, what it seems to be saying there is that you can sell items freely. It never gives any support for buying magic items. So there's the buying and there's the selling factors possibly separate.
Is this based purely on just that it's assigning value? Is that what you're getting at?
Well, I'm like is do buying and selling have different statuses in your campaign? And then I'll say, you know, third edition had prices for all the items and you could buy them for one value and you could sell them for half that. And then fourth edition had values for all the items and you could buy them for this and you could sell them for 1/5 of that, of that number. And then in fifth edition, you don't get prices for the magic items, but let me put you on the spot and talk potions. Are you pro buying? Are you pro buying potions in the game?
My opinion on this has changed when some jerk removed clerics from my game. when that happened, I realized I had to allow for the buying of healing potions. Otherwise, we were in trouble.
The same thing due to someone that I know very well removing clerics from my game as well. So I sympathize, Paul. And for what it's worth, I have had now, and I have it, you know, in my campaign, I had that in a specific place. So there's a particular character in a particular place that did actually was an alchemist. Okay. Mm-hmm. And frankly, as we pointed out in the books of all along, they've said, you know, alchemist characters can make magic potions. They've had that forever. So I feel like an alchemy shop is right in the text and always has been. And so I've always had potions of healing available in my game for a value of 200. And then maybe there's some extra stuff. Maybe there's some extra unexpected stuff in the potion, in the weird hermit witch at the side of the village who's selling that stuff. That's worked super well in my games. And it's been a good way of extracting cash from the players, actually. Mm-hmm. It's been one of the primary things is can you support your monthly expenses plus your healing potions?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Are you selling
only healing potions, or are you selling other kinds of potions as well?
Mostly healing potions, but you know, can be other maybe surprising types. I also have like an anti-poison, like a remove poison.
Right.
Potion that's more expensive. And then maybe, you know, and I've offered them love potions. And they come into the shop, like, can I interest you in a nice love potion? And they're like, nope, that's not what we're here for.
But you're not offering, say, potions of fire breath or flying or invisibility, anything like that.
I probably should. Those particular ones haven't come up. I probably should, similar to your scrolls, like maybe I should be rolling and having a little bit more variety from day to day. Not, you know, they're definitely not come in and buy a barrel of invisibility potion at will.
Yeah. Yeah. If I was really good about it, what I would do is I would let players sell stuff, and I would track who they sold what, and then just recirculate that stuff. I feel like if I was just more on top of my note taking, that's what I would do. I've definitely delighted in moments in the campaign where the players have asked a sage, "Hey, we've heard of this strange location. Do you have any maps of it or to it?" And the sage gladly sells it to them, and then I hand back to them maps either made by them earlier in the campaign or maps made by other player groups. And I go, "Here you go. Here you go. Don't you wish you had made better maps?" Remember that other character who died there? Yep, he had a map on him. It made it back here. Here you go.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah. 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 So I love fantastic. That. I love that. So I mean, that's what I think of when I think of selling stuff, right? Like let's say a player for whatever reason is like, "Oh, we found this great wand of fireballs and we don't want it for some reason, or we want the cash, we're going to sell it." Well, my head's immediately going to go to like, "Well, who's going to buy it? And are you going to be happy that that person now has a wand of fireballs?" Maybe not.
Well, okay. So let me talk. So scrolls. So you're clearly okay with occasionally players buying scrolls, because I've done that in your game. Well,
that goes back to your favorite Holmes Basic D&D, right? In Holmes Basic, there is a rule there, I think, about what it costs to scribe a scroll, right? I think I want to recall that it tells you exactly the cost and time and money to scribe a scroll.
The cost is right out of original D&D, right? And in fact, I have an image prepared for that, Paul. So if you want to pull up, so for what it's worth, if you look in the very first book, the very first original D&D book that is equivalent, little booklet that's equivalent to the player's handbook, it describes magic users. You get one single paragraph about magic users, and it's like magic users, they can't use weapons, they can use a dagger, they get spells, and they, at a higher level, can craft their own magic items. And then it rolls, and then so this is like literally the second paragraph about wizards in the game is here's the cost to create magic items. And I think, Paul, you are looking at basically that first line that for 100 gold pieces per spell, you can make a scroll of spells. And that's copied directly into Holmes Basic.
Yeah.
Now, the thing that I want to press you on is that in original D&D, to be able to craft magic items, you had to be enormously high level. What that text there says is you need to be wizard class, which means 11th level. You need to be 11th level before you can even make a potion of healing or a scroll of spells. Holmes is famous for saying that wizard characters can make scrolls, not anything else, just scrolls, even starting at first level.
Yep. And that's where I ended up with on my Peltar's apprentices making scrolls. Okay. I was like, well, okay. You know. He says they can do it. It seems like a good way to practice. And then I have layers upon layers on top of that of like other expenses and limitations on how many scrolls you can copy into your spell book.
Gotcha.
Chances to learn the spell and, you know, needing to wait to level up to do it, to try it again when you fail and stuff like that. And of course, I assume scrolls are always destroyed the moment you do anything with them, whether it's read it off or try to scribe it.
Right. Right.
So yes, I'm a hard ass about that. If you try to scribe a scroll into your spell book and fail, the scroll is still gone.
Good for you. That's the way it ought to be. Yeah. This is the way, Paul.
Yeah.
It's all risky.
Yeah.
But I was wondering about, because I don't think in, because normally I feel like you're normally looking at Moldvay BX or something like that. And that it's interesting because that rule is not in there, to my knowledge. So really the only rule set that allowed that at first level was either Holmes Basic and then third edition. And then third edition brought it back and you could scribe scrolls at first level.
I don't mind. I like Magic users making scrolls. I like using it as a way that they're maybe going to make a little money between each other by trading and selling them. I like it as a buffer between the, like, can I borrow your spell book? Because, like, no, of course you can't borrow my spell book.
Right.
Like, that's like, no, but maybe I'll scribe a scroll for you.
I like that. I think that's a really, I'm so glad you said that, and you said it at the top of the episode, obviously, and I feel like that's, I need to work that more into my games, because the problem of how do wizards acquire new spells, honestly, I've been too stingy about scrolls in the dungeon, and it kind of hurt my game a little bit, and then as we were talking about before the show started, then suddenly the players find a spell book. And then it's a Niagara Falls of new spells. And then all of a sudden they get like a dozen all at once.
Yep.
And that book gets passed around and everybody winds up with the same spells. And I would be better off, I think, in my game if I gave them in smaller chunks of scrolls. And frankly, the big mistake I make is that I'm rolling random treasure for a dungeon. And frequently, I'll confess, I roll scroll and I go, that's boring. I'm going to roll something else. But if I do that too much, all of a sudden I've removed the main opportunity for wizards to get new spells.
Yep.
That's a mistake I've made.
I mean, I might encourage to possibly, when you get to that point, say, that's boring. What else is also there? Keep the scroll. Add something.
Yep. Okay. Yep. I can get behind that. Yeah, it's funny with the. It's funny because again, that's another rule that has the dial's gone all over the map about where can wizards craft items over editions, and I agree. Joshua just pointed out it really does seem too high. If you're a wizard of 11th level, why are you going to spend a week of your valuable time making a read magic scroll?
Yeah, right?
That just doesn't.
Yeah,
just on the face of it, just doesn't seem beginning reasonable. So I dial down those requirements in my games. They were dialed down in other editions, and that makes a whole lot of sense to me as well. It's funny because, like, you go from, you know, zero edition to first edition, and Gygax dialed that down to now you only need to be seventh level. You need to be seventh level before you can make a read magic scroll. And then that dial went down and down and down later on, which could make sense. So Paul, you were saying you're getting more comfortable with buying magic items as long as they're consumable, right? Just looking at this table here, that might seem interesting. Yeah. What about magic arrows?
Interesting.
What about like a plus one arrow that gets used up anytime you shoot?
That's the next question: is the arrow used up? Right? Do arrows get consumed by firing them? Can I not go collect the arrow and reuse it? What do you do for that?
If you look in the details of most editions of D&D, they said they're used up. I think the classic rule is if it hits, definitely used up. If it misses, 50-50.
Interesting. What do you do in general for arrows? Like I'm a first level fighter. I have a dozen arrows. I shoot 8 of them during a fight. Can I go collect them at the end of the fight?
I think I've been doing the same thing for mundane arrows. I think I've been letting the characters pick up half of the misses.
Interesting.
And I don't roll for it, but if they miss 4 times, I let them just go grab 2.
I do something roughly similar, which is 50% is roughly in my head, but I do make them roll for it. I say, great, you shot 8 arrows, roll 8d6. Every 4 plus is an arrow you found that's still whole and usable. Gotcha. So then I've applied that to magic arrows where I say that, like, again, like, you know, if the arrow didn't break, you can pluck it and reuse it. So I don't really care if it hit or not. I just care, like, you know, did it break when it struck whatever it struck?
I'm on board with the, if it hits, then it's definitely gone. I feel like that feels balanced to me for Magic Numbers. Is that reasonable?
It's just a little more tracking than I want to do. It's just a little more, more inventory than I want to bother keeping.
That makes sense.
I just want to know, you wrote tick marks as you fired, then that's the number of dice you roll, and let's roll to see how many are recoverable.
That's legitimate.
Yeah.
Is that how that works? Now I feel like I need to go research. Like if you actually strike something with an arrow, can you pull it out and reuse it, or is it gunked up and not usable anymore? Now I feel like I should know that.
I mean,
does anybody know that
from childhood archery? I would say, of course they're all recoverable, 100%. I go over to the target, I pull them out, I reuse them. I don't destroy my arrows.
I've done that many times. Okay, so I lose arrows in the earth, right? They sink into the earth, and I never find them after an hour of hunting.
If you're a poor archer, I mean that. Yeah, I mean, you don't hit the target, man.
Okay. Or Paul, wait, yeah. Listen, please. Yeah. Can I speak?
Yeah.
Can I speak?
Yeah. Go for it.
The last time I did archery, I put my target up, right, at my frankly dad's recommendation. Right, I put my target up. And then there was a bale of hay, and it was up against a wagon, actually our hay wagon down at my folks' place. And I shot three arrows, and it went right through the target, right through the hay bale, into the wagon, shattered to pieces. And I broke all of my arrows, right? Every single 1, 2, 3, 4, right after, shattered to pieces. Wow. And I walked back with the bow. I go, Dad, we got to go down to the Kittery Trading Post because I'm out of arrows.
That is hilarious. I've never seen that, honestly. I gotta say, from years of going to summer camp, it was and the worst case scenario was that the arrow went so deep into the hay that you had to go dig around in the hay for it. But maybe because it was summer camp, maybe they were giving us somewhat underpowered bows, and it was less likely that.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say. I actually have a fairly high powered hunting bow that draws 60 or 80 pounds or something like that. And it will go right through many, many bales of hay, actually.
Yeah. And of course, we're talking about target shooting. So those arrows, they probably have a flat head, right? Or just a pointed head rather than like a barbed head, which I always imagine in D&D, you're probably shooting with like a big honking, you know, more serious head that's more likely to either get stuck or break or do something. Right. Yeah.
Totally.
Anyway, oh man, we're down the rabbit hole.
So let's say you get half back. Okay, let's say you even have magic arrows and you get half of them back, regardless of what happened. Purchasable in a store?
Nope, I don't allow it.
No, I'm hearing no. Okay, all right.
No,
okay.
I don't allow it. Great. Let me ask you this one though. How about wands?
Yep.
Can I recharge my wand?
Well, that was my next question. Okay, you should be, and I've never come up with a really great rule that I was super happy with. There was an article in Dragon Magazine, it was like I think in the 80s or 90s, that I fell in love with because it had a specific construction technique for every single different wand in AD&D. And it still didn't, and I guess it wound up just like, and then you just cast spells into it, and one spell's one charge.
Yep.
And I feel like I wish there was something a little bit more esoteric for the recharging.
Let me give you what I've done, which this requires more tracking. So if you want to deal with this, go for it. I limited it to stuff like combat wands, magic missile, fireball, etc., lightning wands. This is less fun when it's like a wand of, I don't know what, invisibility? Is that a thing? I don't know. Anyway,
Usually, here you go.
Wand of magic missiles. I assume every wand of magic missiles has a different number of maximum charges. It is not like they don't all hold 10 or 100 or whatever. They have a variable number, which I roll for and I write down and I don't tell the players. I also don't assume it has that many charges still in it when they find it. So it might have, 15 max charges and it currently has 7 in it. Great. When the players want to recharge it, they have to cast magic missile at the wand and it sucks it in. Great, you've just put one more charge in it. If you put more charges into a wand than it can hold, it will explode and release all of them. And you don't get to know the numbers.
Wow.
There you go. That's what I've done. And yes, I have had a player blow themselves up and die from overcharging a magic missile wand. Yeah. It was a brilliant moment in the game. Everybody enjoyed it quite a bit. And the player was brutally mocked. Brutally mocked for having a wand of magic missiles explode in his face. He's like, I'm going to push it. And he knew it. Wow. Like, he knew he was gambling. He was like, I'm pretty sure that this thing holds more than five charges. So I'm going to keep going. Right. And it did. And it holds, hell, I can't remember what it was. It was like a dozen or something. But he's like, okay, 12. Oh, it's still holding. Oh, great. We're going to go more. Here's charge number 13. Boom. Yeah, it was great.
Now, we should say, I mean, possibly there's some newer players that mm-hmm. are not aware that there was a huge switch. And Eric just reminded us in chat, there's a huge switch in how wands worked in 5th edition. In prior editions, you had a fixed number of charges, and once you used it, the charge was just gone. And initially, there could be, and here's Eric saying, wands in 5th edition recharge at dawn, which is sort of boring. I like that method better.
Yeah. Yeah, 5th edition, I think, right, they have like a charges per, it's basically a charges per day, right? Rather than a total right. charges right. for the lifetime of the wand, it's the right. charges per day.
Kind right, of. Right. Yeah. And it's, and to my, you know, historical understanding, it's a really small number. In original D&D, wands started off with 100 charges, 100 charges over its lifetime, no more, no less. And in 5th edition, now it's like, what, 5? It might be like... three right, or again, five it's, or something like that on the day
because it's a per day
yeah
thing, right
right
right I want right. there to be a good number right. of charges. I feel like 100 is too much, but I like to randomize it, so I might just toss a couple d20s, like 2 or 3 d20. That's right. How many
right I can see. I mean, so the price, the construction price list in original D&D that we were looking before, if I crunch numbers on that, like I find that like about 20 seems about right. So about 20 charges winds up being about the same value as if you made 20 scrolls mm-hmm. under that pricing mm-hmm. system. So I generally go for 20 in a wand, and I think that's the same thing they did in BX, I believe. That Moldvay did. So, and 20 feels like a number that you're going to keep track of. Like if I have like, oh, now I've got 86, now I've got 85, now I've got 84. That doesn't seem like there's any pressure around yeah. that. But like 20, yeah. and I'm getting through the teens, and then I'm in the single digits. Then you're keeping track of that.
Yep.
So I agree, 100's too much. And if you find one, certainly I'll roll a D20, frankly, to see how many's left in it right now.
Great.
I would not. Great. I would not want people going out and buying wands, right? So I would definitely yeah. not want to have people go out and purchase wands from a Harry Potter style wand store.
Yeah, right. Now I have allowed them to pay gotcha. Again, since I have this crazy recharging rule. I have allowed them to pay NPC magic users to do the recharging for them. But it's expensive.
Yeah, that makes sense
because it's risky.
Right. Yep, that makes sense. Yep. Right.
Yeah.
And Eric's reminding us that in 5th edition, now the rule is that wands have 7 charges on the day and staves have 10. Staves have always had more by mm-hmm. either 50% or 100. So that's,
well, then,
that's
then you get two into like the multifunction staff that has like 3 different effects. Right. And then it takes yep. 1 charge to do this and 2 charges to do that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which I think is fun. I like that. That's fun stuff. But
yes. And I'll say that our friend Max had one of those in the last D&D game I ran for a one session, and had the top end staff of power, which is the most powerful staff in the game. And in I believe the very first encounter room, he ran into a trap that had a smashing pillar, and smashed his character, cracked the staff of power, blew him up. And had to go find a new character.
Exploding magic items are just wonderful.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Yeah. So, yeah.
So,
yeah.
Magic swords. Okay, so I'm going to top off. So, what's your feeling about a magic, you know, plus one sword? Can you go say, I need to buy a plus one sword here? It's Wednesday.
Nope. Absolutely not. Nope. Still super valuable, frankly. And you get to that point in the game where the characters are getting higher level and they start getting fancier magic weapons, right? So now my fighter had a plus one sword at level 3, but now he's level 7 and he's got a, you know, plus right. 2 flame tongue or whatever, and he's yeah. still carrying around that plus one sword as a backup or whatever.
Yep.
But yep. now we're level 7, we're starting to face off monsters that require magic, and so like having those crappy plus one weapons is important because they will start trading them off. Oh, let me give it to the thief. Let me give this, you know, to, not a sword, but maybe a dagger to the a plus one dagger to the wizard. So he's got something. Yeah. Right. So that when we face something that requires magic, at least everybody has something. Because I do like that moment, frankly, in the power curve of the game. I'd like the moment where they start facing off on things that require magic to hit, and only like two or three of the players can actually do anything about it.
I agree.
And the other players are going, oh no, oh no, we don't have enough magic weapons.
Right.
I love that. Right. I love that.
It's an, and what do they do at that point, right? They, that that tends to be a point where suddenly every they get create they have to get creative.
They have to be creative.
You're not gonna, they, nobody's going to want to stand around and just go like literally do nothing. So they're going to, do I try to trip it? Do I try to tie it up with a rope? Do I blind it with a sack?
Yep. Right. And then pretty much after that fight is when they then the players now have a new goal of, oh crap, we need to get more magic weapons. Right. So let's start figuring out where we can go to find more magic weapons. Right. And I love, I, you know, like I said, anytime there's a, the players identify a need, it's a chance to introduce adventure.
I agree. I agree with that. Yeah. Try it. I try to pivot things into more adventures, and that's what the game should be about.
That's, I agree.
I agree.
I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
All right.
There you go.
Well, I'm glad we that one we settled, Paul. That one we settled. Magic, general magic shops, no. Some potions, some scrolls, hiring people to recharge your wands, that's fair game. If you know, maybe this fifth edition idea of a secret auction house that actually becomes itself an adventure, maybe something got stolen by the thieves. I can see that.
Or I mean, there's so many things you could do with that, and like my head immediately went to now, like if you generally know this magic item is worth 1,000 gold pieces, well, what if someone comes to that auction who's willing to pay much more, right? Let's introduce a little variability into the pricing, and then let's, like, I think that's an interesting session where the players just get ridiculously, let's see how high I can upbid them, right? And then either they're going to pay way too much money for this magic item, or they're going to get outbid by this person, and then they're going to have to find out, well, why is this person so interested in this magic item, and what's going on there?
You know, it's funny
there?
Because I've seen that in real life, and the, you know, like, a thought that was running around in my head for this particular topic is, you know, as 21st century Americans, is it possible that we have some amount of blinders on in our capitalist society that everything has a price? So many of us, and, you know, Frank Mentzer says it in Beckme, and the third edition rules basically says many of us wind up saying, well, clearly, for the right price, anything is purchasable. Mm. And like in first edition, Gygax even had prices for artifacts, right? So unique, one-of-a-kind artifacts, like the Throne of the Gods, 50,000 gold pieces or whatever it is, right? Yeah, and even though it's an immovable part of a mountain, I don't know, whatever. But nonetheless, he felt there had to be a price. And so, you know, for our current culture, the, you know, I've been explicitly told by authority figures in my life, like, everything has a price. And I have seen, you know, the things that I've seen in the farming community is someone raises like a beloved pair of working oxen, right? And they've worked with them, and they're kind of in, you know, they're kind of pets and they're kind of partners. And someone comes on the farm and says, "I want to. That's a great team of oxen. I want to buy them." And the person says, "They are not for sale." And the stranger says, "Everything has a price. You name the price, and I'm going to pay it." And person A says, you know, quotes what seems to them a ridiculously high price. And person B says, yep, you got it. Here's a check. And they drive off with your oxen. Right. And so it's you know, the discussion today made me think about are there other cultures where that's not, where that wouldn't happen, right? Are there things in the world where people just absolutely would not allow it to be purchased? And I'm thinking, like, I don't know, like a national park? Or something like that. The Taj Mahal, would that, you know, are there things that are just simply off limits that a person would never ever think about forking, you know, accepting money to fork it over? And maybe that should be part of our non-American, non-colonial fantasy worlds as well. There's probably going to be angry comments about what I just said.
don't know. I think it's reasonable. I think it's interesting because it's inspiring in me thoughts of like what is, you know, take into consideration who you're buying it from and what do they want.
Right.
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 And yeah, maybe they're just like, this is my beloved. I would never part with this. This is like, you know, whatever. It's an intelligent sword that I have a relationship with. Like I can't sell my children. Right. But on the other hand, like, what if it's somebody who wants a very specific price that can't be counted in gold, right? What if it's somebody who wants something, you know, I'm trying to think of something truly terrible here and not coming up with a great, a great option. But like, you know, yeah, I need you to go do this favor for me, or I need you to go on this quest.
I need you assassinate my cousin so I can ascend to the throne.
Right. There you go. There you go.
Right.
Yeah. Something pretty morally reprehensible. What are you willing to do for this thing?
That's right. Great. Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. So I agree. Right, maybe not cash, but something that turns into an event.
Yeah. That's great. We have just a few minutes left here, Dan. Do you have any final thoughts on the buying and selling of magic items?
This is one that maybe we're unusually of like mind on, Paul. I also am pretty comfortable with some potions and scrolls being sold, or a wizard giving a service of a single spell, and non-consumable. Higher powered magic items. I would be fairly uncomfortable having a magic shop in my dungeon that stuff was just being forked over all the time.
Me too.
I don't mind having some, you know, some NPCs demand them as tolls. So if I have a landowning wizard that says you got to give me a magic item to get across my territory, I'm fine with that. But I still don't want to put a dollar sign on what that cost.
I think I'm going to stand by my actual original statement here, Dan, which is I simply never, ever do it, except when I do.
Paul, you contain multitudes.
viewers, do you have any feedback for us? Any further interesting angles? Especially, I'm curious about edge cases of, like we were talking about, rechargeable wands. Or are there other edge cases where you think, like, yeah, but this case? I would love to hear about those or other ways that buying and selling magic items have impacted your campaign. Leave us some comments in the video, please. We'd love to hear your thoughts, and perhaps that will spawn off additional conversation down the road.
Yeah, definitely. And if you're new to the show, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us, the Wandering DMs, on sites like YouTube and Twitch and Twitter and Facebook and also GitHub, if you're a coder. And we have the handle Wandering DMs on all of the sites. So please look for us there and follow and get updates on upcoming shows.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can get those podcasts at our website at wanderingdms.com. If you've been watching, they've been pouring out recently. We got a little backlog of them, but they're coming through now. So go check it out there. Or you can also get our podcast at sites like Google Podcasts or iTunes or Spotify. If you are listening to this show right now on one of those sites, please take a moment to rate and review us there. That helps other users of those sites find us, and we really appreciate it.
Yeah, we really do. And of course, huge thanks to our patrons who support the Wandering DM shows. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And you're going to see our three different tiers there. We have discounts on merch. We have access to our private Discord server, all kinds of great discussions happening there, monthly behind-the-scenes video polls and surveys, and after-party chat, like we'll have this Sunday in about 10 minutes. We'll be on Discord. Upcoming shows, Paul should be back tomorrow night, Monday, for more 10 Dead Rats. Isabel and I are working real hard trying to find a Saturday that we can have a Book of War show that she's not working on a movie here in New York or something like that, which has been happening quite a lot. So hopefully, maybe this week, if not the next week. But don't forget, of course, we are live every Sunday here at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So we hope you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.